the publisher, and the screaming could be heard. There was actual screaming, but, you know, the First Amendment won.
We're going to do part two of this discussion just to give people a sense of the pressure at that time as we move into this new case. James Goodell is former vice president and general counsel for The New York Times, author of Fighting for the Press, The Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Tune in to KABU on June 22nd and 23rd for our live broadcast for Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival. We'll start the broadcast from King School Park and Good in the Hood Saturday at 2 p.m. Bands include the Elliot Young Band, Hot Tea Cold, Ronnie Wright, Cool Breeze, and more. Sunday, we'll start the broadcast at noon and we'll feature Funky Fusion featuring Amanda Ryan, the Norman Sylvester Band, Soul Vaccination, and more. Again, that's Good in the Hood, a multicultural music, arts, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experiences to strengthen unity in the community. The broadcast will be Saturday, June 22nd from 2 to 10 p.m. and Sunday, June 23rd from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Four Peaks Music Festival, June 20th through 23rd at Stevenson Ranch in Bend, Oregon. Four Peaks Music Festival is a four-day music event featuring an eclectic array of national, regional, and local bands. Performers include Poor Man's Whiskey, Los Lobos, Sister Sparrow, The Drunken Hearts, and many more. There will also be food, craft vendors, a kid zone, and more. Again, that's the Four Peaks Music Festival, June 20th through 23rd at Stevenson Ranch, 21085 Knott Road in Bend, Oregon. More information can be found at KABU.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening, this is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Jim James of My Morning Jacket and the Claypool-Lennon Delirium, featuring Les Claypool and Sean Lennon, Thursday, June 27th. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com. It's 5:02, time for the KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Salvation Army Women's Shelter closes because of poor grant writing.
President Donald Trump says he will begin rounding up undocumented migrants in large numbers.
And in international news, a tsunami warning was issued after a large earthquake in Japan.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, June 18th, 2019. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Salvation Army Female Emergency Shelter in downtown Portland, also known as SAFES, is closing this summer. SAFES opened in 1999, providing housing to single houseless women. In 2008, it started receiving money from the Portland Housing Bureau. However, the funding changed when Multnomah County consolidated their houseless services into the Joint Office of Homeless Services, which requires a more lengthy application process for funding. Reviewers of the Salvation Army's application said that shelter officials did not provide adequate answers to questions about trauma that houseless women face, equity issues, and how the shelter works with other organizations to help transition women to permanent housing. On Monday, a Joint Office staff member began interviewing the 80 women that reside at SAFES to help them find another shelter or some other type of temporary or permanent housing. The closure of SAFES will not reduce the total number of shelter beds in the Portland area, since new shelters will open this summer and other temporary shelter locations have been extended. The Salvation Army has come under fire in the past by LGBTQ activists, and the Portland shelter itself has previously been criticized for its treatment of residents and the handling of a transgender woman's case in 2017.
The Oregon House of Representatives has passed a controversial climate policy bill on a 36-24 vote.
House Republicans kept the debate going for nearly 6.5 hours to argue that the bill would have a disastrous effect on jobs, energy prices, and Oregon's economy, all for a, quote, imperceptible impact on global greenhouse gas emissions. The policy would require companies in the utility, transportation, and industrial sectors to buy emission allowances in a state-run auction or on a secondary market to cover each metric ton of pollution their operations emit. As the state reduces the supply of allowances, they will get more and more expensive, increasing fossil fuel prices and incentivizing business and consumers to reduce their consumption and emissions. The bill would also offer free emission allowances until 2030 for Oregon's two largest electric utilities, PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric. Supporters of the bill hope it will lead to a wholesale reduction in Oregonians' use of fossil fuels and an associated decrease in greenhouse gas emissions equivalent to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. The bill will now head to the Senate, where Democrats can only afford to lose 2 of their members' votes. This is Nikita Gautam reporting for KBOO News.
The Oregon Health Authority has issued a public health advisory for Cannon Beach. Health officials say they have discovered higher than normal levels of fecal bacteria in the ocean waters at Cannon Beach. The bacteria can cause diarrhea, stomach cramps, skin rashes, upper respiratory infections, and other illnesses. Young children and the elderly are the most susceptible. According to health officials, the increased fecal bacteria levels can come from both shore and inland sources, such as stormwater runoff, sewer overflows, failing septic systems, and animal waste. Officials are asking anyone visiting Cannon Beach to avoid the water until the advisory is lifted. Visitors should also avoid wading in nearby creeks, pools of water on the beach, discolored water, or water runoff flowing into the ocean.
In a pair of tweets Monday night, President Donald Trump said U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement will begin the process of removing millions of undocumented immigrants next week. The Washington Post reports that Trump and his senior immigration advisor, Stephen Miller, have been urging Homeland Security officials to arrest and remove thousands of family members whose cases have been expedited in a plan known as the, quote, rocket docket. Also on Monday, the Trump administration officially announced it would cut millions of dollars in foreign aid to Central America until those countries make further efforts to prevent their citizens from migrating. Lawmakers fear the end of American assistance to the Northern Triangle will only worsen the rampant poverty and political instability of that region. In recent days, however, U.S. officials have said that the operation is not imminent. The president's plan to deport millions is inconsistent with the agency's staffing and budgetary challenges. ICE arrests within the U.S. interior have declined in recent months due to the high demand of agents needed to manage the surge of migrant families at the southern border.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, the Lummi Nation launches a campaign for orca protection, a Senate committee will hold a hearing on public safety bills, and a new community center opens on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of the Lummi Nation in Washington and scientists have launched a campaign for the restoration of the Salish Sea and orca protection, KCPQ reports. The Salish Sea campaign seeks a study of human impacts and Navy tests as stressors. The tribe will measure sea health by using salmon data from the 1980s as a baseline. Efforts to free killer whale Lolita from captivity is also of concern to the tribe. Rallies have been held across the country seeking the return of the whale from a Miami aquarium. A legislative hearing on public safety and missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is scheduled for Wednesday in the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. Senators will hear testimony on 5 bills which address violence and safety, including Savannah's Act and the newly introduced Bridging Agency Data Gaps and Ensuring Safety for Native Communities Act. A tribal judge, a tribal leader, and federal officials are listed as witnesses. Tribes and Native organizations across the country are backing the bill bills calling for greater awareness and resources to address missing and murdered Indigenous people. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is collaborating on a genetic study exploring historical trauma and the DNA of Native people. The research is focusing on Huna people in Alaska. The study is being conducted by researchers from the University of Illinois. The project is taking place this week in Juneau, and further data gathering is planned for Huna later this summer or fall. The research is also in coordination with the Huna Indian Association and consultation with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. A new community center is open on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. It's one of the only meeting spaces in the area. A project by the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation. China Lockett has more.
The Thunder Valley Community Center is a large open space with concrete floors and white walls covered in windows. There's a clean, new age feeling to the room, but designers were intentional about incorporating traditional details. Willie White is the communications director at Thunder Valley.
When you look at the traditional teepee structure, when you're inside, you see everything. You see the poles, you see the rope. There's nothing that's hidden, and so that's the same concept that's put into this space. Is you get to see the beams, you get to see the ventilations, you see the wiring.
White says the combination of new and traditional is a way to specify the architecture to Oglala Lakota Sioux people and make them feel welcome. This space is energy efficient and equipped with high-end technology. There's a massive projector and sound system that turn on with the push of a button.
When we were looking at what kind of system we wanted to put in here, we wanted to make sure that it had a good ROI, a return on investment. It was something that we can give the best to our community, and so that's what this whole system is. It's all integrated within the building.
Meeting spaces aren't a new concept, but White says this spot is filling a need on Pine Ridge. Events and conferences are scheduled for the coming months, and there's even a summer wedding reserved. A bunker space in the building sleeps 14 people and includes showers. White says the option to sleep in the center makes events more convenient for people in the rural area.
It's really about fostering community and doing that in a space that's innovative and a space that is designed with intention and function and giving them the resources and the tools that they need to do whatever they want to do in this space.
White says developers plan to add more accommodations to the building in the coming months. I'm China Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Good evening. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, Is It You or Is It Me? And at 7, Calculated Conversations. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 71 degrees. Today in history. In 1966, Dr. Samuel Nabrit becomes the first African American to serve on the Atomic Energy Commission. Nabrit was also the first Morehouse College graduate to earn a PhD. He was also the first African American to be awarded a doctoral degree from Brown University. The quote of the day is from American activist and founder of the Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman, who said, quote, "Education is for improving the lives of others and for leaving your community and world better than you found it."
The U.S. has announced a $250 million aid package for Ukraine to strengthen the country's naval and land capabilities. The Pentagon also said they would provide Ukraine with sniper rifles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, radar, night vision equipment, and naval training. Lieutenant Colonel Carla M. Gleason, a Pentagon spokesperson, said, quote, the United States remains committed to helping Ukraine. These reforms will bolster Ukraine's ability to defend its territorial integrity in support of a secure, prosperous, democratic, and free Ukraine. Since Russia annexed the Crimean Peninsula and Moscow-backed separatists seized parts of eastern Ukraine in 2014, the Pentagon has provided about $1.5 billion in defense funding to the country. About 13,000 people have been killed in the region since the conflict began. Ukraine and its allies accuse Russia of funneling troops and arms to the pro-Moscow rebels across the border. However, Russia denies these allegations.
A 6.7 magnitude earthquake hit Japan Tuesday afternoon. The quake lasted 20 seconds and caused thousands to lose power. Several bullet trains were also suspended, and 1,500 residents were left in the dark. No major injuries were reported. The quake hit approximately 20 miles off the western edge of Japan's coast. A tsunami warning was issued for the country, but only minor waves were observed, and the warning was lifted 3 hours later. No warning beyond the western coast of Japan was made, and all 7 nuclear reactors in the tsunami warning area were offline at the time and reported no abnormalities. Fukushima, the site of a nuclear disaster due to a 2011 tsunami, was not threatened by the tsunami warning. That earthquake measured 9.0 and was responsible for 18,000 deaths. The earthquake was relatively shallow, located 9 miles below the surface of the sea. Shallow quakes tend to cause more surface damage.
A new scientific expedition has discovered that permafrost in the Canadian Arctic is thawing 70 years earlier than predicted. The expedition team was from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. They were shocked by how quickly a succession of unusually hot summers had destabilized the upper layers of giant subterranean ice blocks that had previously been frozen solid for millennia. The team's findings were published just as governments are meeting in Bonn, Germany, for the United Nations climate negotiations. Scientists are worried about the permafrost because rapid thawing could release large quantities of heat-trapping gas, creating a feedback loop that would in turn lead to even faster temperature rises.
This Saturday, the Tualatin River Keepers celebrate their 30th annual Tualatin River Discovery Day. Here to talk about the Tualatin River Keepers and their work is Executive Director Chris Bellier. Thanks for coming in, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. The River Keepers are a national movement. Can you give us a brief history of that movement?
I'd be happy to. All of us that carry the Keeper moniker actually fall under an umbrella organization called the Waterkeeper Alliance. My first exposure actually to the Keeper Alliance was through Cook Inlet Keeper and just south of Anchorage, Alaska, to give you an idea of the many water bodies it encompasses. Lots of people don't know that little factoid. But for my purposes today, I'm the executive director of the Tualatin River Keepers, and we're proud members of that alliance. And I would say that the whole Keeper movement came about in a large part due to some very passionate visionary activists and the emergence of the Clean Water Act in the 1970s. Without the Clean Water Act, we would not have had the tools to do the work we have done to bring a lot of rivers that were close to the brink of disaster, like the Tualatin and even the Willamette, back to where they are today, where folks can embrace them and they have become the lifeline of our communities.
So where is the Tualatin River?
The Tualatin River is largely within the parameters of Washington County, although there are parts of it that are also in Multnomah and Clackamas. People don't frequently understand that the Tualatin River, there is a main stem, but it's fed by a very intricate and dendritic pattern of tributaries that are throughout the region, throughout the Willamette Valley. It's just south of Portland, the easiest access parts, and it's considered within the Portland metro region.
What are some of the cities that river touches?
Of course, Tualatin and Tigard, West Lynn, Hillsboro, Beaverton, even going up to Gaston, Forest Grove. It's a pretty long-reaching river, almost 80 miles from the Coast Range to where it meets up with the Willamette at Lake Oswego.
So there must be a lot of wildlife that depend on that. Could you tell me some of the species that are dependent on that river?
Oh, I'd love to, because some of them are my personal favorites and they're iconic species for the Pacific Northwest. We, of course, have anadromous fish, salmonids,
What is a salmonid?
A salmonid is a species. It's a family of fish. They are the fish like salmon and steelhead that spend part of their life in freshwater and part of their life in the ocean. They're fascinating species, and we do not have time for me to share my passion for them here. But this river does support a threatened, listed under the Endangered Species Act, threatened winter steelhead run. It supports any number of trout, turtles, freshwater mussels, many birds, plant species. The watershed itself is rich and vibrant and all reliant on the waters of this river and her tributaries.
And so what are some of the issues that are faced in the Tualatin right now?
Well, when we first formed 30 years ago, the landscape looked different. This river was once called the Tualatin, and it was pretty much open sewage. It's changed very much since that day, and it's a river now that people can enjoy. You can kayak, you can paddleboard. You know, there are 400,000 people in the upper reaches of the river who use it as a drinking water supply. But today, the forces that threaten the integrity and specifically the natural integrity of the river are things related to stormwater runoff and hyperdevelopment in the region. As the population in this region grows, the pressures on that river have increased, and we're seeing things now that we did not see in our original days, and we spend a lot of our time figuring out creative ways to do it that can allow the natural of the integrity of the riverine system to exist alongside human needs and thriving communities.
And so what are the creative ways that you've been kind of dealing with these issues?
You know, it's all about partnerships. One partnership that's emerging for us right now, and I'm very, very excited about, is working with the descendants of the original landowners of the watershed, the folks who were here when the settlers first arrived. There's a species in the river that you may or may know of called the lamprey, and it is very important to the people. The descendants of the ancestral peoples of our watershed are in the Grand Ronde. They are the tribes of the Grand Ronde. And lamprey is an important species for them, and it's becoming an important species for us because we find it's a thread that can tie us together in our quest to achieve our same goals about ecosystem stability and preserving the things that are natural there, not only for generations now, but generations to come, and in honor of those who were here before.
Could you explain what the storm drain mural project is?
Well, that speaks again to the creative ways we're looking to reach people about what's facing the river. A lot of people don't know that what goes down the storm drain actually ends up in the river, and it's not treated. A lot of people, I think, assume it goes through a sewer treatment. That is not always the case. By doing the storm water and the storm drain murals, it becomes a community affair. We engage with artists at the community level and have them paint these very compelling images on an actual storm drain. We're doing one currently in Tualatin that bring people to the drain, look at the drain, realize what's going in there, and maybe that will both connect folks to the river but also alter their behavior in small ways. Maybe you don't want to throw your cigarette butt down that drain.
So this weekend is your 30th anniversary of the Tualatin River Keepers. What is one of the proudest moments that you've experienced in your time with the River Keepers?
You know, the thing that I think I'm the proudest of is we've maintained not only the integrity of the ecosystem itself, but the integrity of the community and of the organization. We're a very small grassroots environmental organization. I cut my teeth decades ago doing this kind of work, and it's actually fun and soul-fulfilling to me to be able to do this now in a day when a lot of environmental activism is taking off on a very large scale. This is keeping it real, as my son would say.
So can you tell our listeners a little bit about what exactly is happening this weekend at the 30th annual Tualatin River Discovery Day?
Well, 30 years ago, a handful of pretty passionate community members who ultimately started the Tualatin River Keepers, there was a transportation project that was threatening small farms in the region, and they were very worried about that, and they felt that the best way to get people involved and passionate about the river would to actually provide them an experience to be on the river and alongside the river. And it's really about place-based education and introducing folks to the natural system in ways that they can relate to. And P.S., you get to have fun.
So where on the river is this event going to be held?
It starts at Tualatin Community Park, which is right close to downtown Tualatin. It's an easy ride down from Portland, and you take either of the Tualatin exits. And it ends at Borland Park, which is a new metro acquisition in the watershed. And then folks will be shuttled back to their cars at Tualatin Community Park. It really is a day we expect to host about 150 paddlers. There'll be information booths, watermelon, and my colleagues would be angry with me if I didn't mention there would also be cake.
So, could you show up with a tube and float down from one park to the other on the river, or just check out the events?
Absolutely. That we do have spaces for people to bring their own equipment, but please let us know so that we can accommodate you.
And so other than attending these festivities, how else can our listeners support the work of the Tualatin River Keepers?
Find out about us. Embrace us. A lot of folks in Portland don't really know we're down there. I live in Inner Northeast, and I didn't know much about it when I took this position. But, you know, it really is a gem, and it's a little oasis. It's a slow-moving river. It's a beautiful landscape. Many people have become acclimated to coming to that part of the metro region for the vineyards and for produce stands and for flowers and tulip festivals. Come down and enjoy our river. And then once you do, support us. Become a member. Write us a check. I have to do that. Come support us and help us do this work going forward, because you know what? It's everyone's river.
So if they do want to, you know, help out and donate and cut you that check, do you have a website that they can visit? Are you on Facebook or Twitter? Where can they search you?
Well, we have a homepage. We're on Facebook. We have Twitter. We have Instagram. The latter of these two, I must admit, I'm a little bit of a Luddite, so my staff would have to direct you to that. But we are very open on social media platforms, and we're open for business. Come visit at our office.
We will. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for being here. That was Chris Ballier, Executive Director at the Tualatin River Keepers. You can find out more about them on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or their website, TualatinRiverKeepers.org. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 18th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Ron Bede, Tave Fiche-Drake, Alex Connor, Jason Rizzitello, Joseph Lyons, Lindsley Rollins, and Nikita Gotam. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9 a.m., it's Politics of Living. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Food Show. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become one of those members, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Hello, Portland. Hello, America. It is almost 5:30, and you are listening to Totality of Circumstances. This is a show that's focused on policing in Portland and in the United States and around the world. Today we'll be mostly focused on Portland, but we also try to focus on the community perspective on policing and try to look at policing from a holistic point of view. So, my name is Sam Bowman. Jasmine Moneymaker is usually my co-host, but she is flagrantly and deliberately out of the country today. So we are going to start with an event that was held yesterday. Yesterday, the family of Patrick Kimmons held a celebration of his life on what would have been his 29th birthday. On September 30th of last year, two Portland police officers shot and killed Kimmons in a parking lot at the corner of Southwest 3rd and Harvey Milk. Kimmons had allegedly shot and wounded two other people in the parking lot moments before the officers shot him. While the local criminal justice system has largely treated the Kimmons shooting as a regrettable, if justifiable, police killing, the details of what happened are still strongly disputed by the Kimmons family, their advocates, and many in the community. When I last spoke with Letha Winston, Kimmons' mother, back in January, she alleged that the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office had edited the surveillance footage of the parking lot to make it look as though Kimmons had an arm raised towards the officers. I asked her last week about how the city has responded since then. I remember the last time we spoke that you had been protesting at City Hall. Among other things, you were demanding the release of the original video footage that you'd seen. What has been the result of your demands to the city?
There is no results at this time. I went my last meeting there with Ted Wheeler and Joanne Hardesty. Ted Wheeler, I told him what I had to say about the video and about the police being held accountable for their action. And he looked at Joanne Hardesty and asked her, do you have anything to say or any answers, towards Letha Winston? And she shook her head no. And he said, thanks for coming. So for all the murders that was questioned to him, all he had to say was thanks for coming.
Wow. Was that the entirety of that meeting?
Yeah. And so just a couple of days ago, as I was sitting down at work thinking, that's not only the video that I demand to see. There's another video circling around somewhere because they stopped the video after the shots was fired. But where is the front of the video? It didn't stop right there. That video kept going. So where is the rest of the video where we can see the police actually over Patrick and the rest of it? That video was a lot longer than that.
Yeah, because it was a surveillance video, right? So it would have just kept running, I imagine.
It would have kept running for the whole entire thing. So where is the rest of the video is the question.
Yesterday was Kimmons' birthday, and the event held at the location where he was killed was billed as both a celebration of his life and as a protest. Letha Winston's unexpected position as the mother of a prominent victim of police violence has put her on a track of activism alongside several other families in the region who are starting to work together to change things. What other organizing efforts have you been involved in the meantime here?
I am with Pacific Family Circle. I had joined them in Feed the Fire a couple weeks ago. Feed the Fire is another protest that we do in remembrance of all our soldiers that have lost their life due to police killings. I get out here by myself and protest at Multnomah County Courthouse as well. I go to Northeast Precinct on MLK and Killingsworth as well. So I'm pretty much all over. And I'm also working on opening up an organization called Mothers Movement as we hold police accountable is what it's going to be called. So I got a lot of things that I'm working on right now.
When you say you show up at North Precinct, do you invite members of the public to join you in that?
I do. I do Facebook events, pages every time I go. And when we go over there to Northeast, we We rage pretty loud. We draw a lot of attention. A lot of people don't know what's going on. They stop, they get out. Crew workers that's working on the pavement, they don't know what's going on. They stop, they get out, hold up a sign. So yeah, we get out here, and I have a pretty good team.
Do you have one of those planned for any time coming up soon?
So after Patrick's celebration, we are going to move forward on to back to our marching, because we're going to go ahead and march the whole month of June. We want to get a large community nationwide, hold police accountable, march together, peaceful march together. We want the nation, everybody from everywhere, Vancouver, Washington, wherever you're coming from, to come join us for this event that's going to be coming up in downtown Portland at Multnomah County Courthouse. We want a large amount of people. We need to get out here and protest and make this police precinct do their job the correct way and not just shoot to kill.
What day is that happening?
So Patrick's celebration is on the 17th, so we're going to go ahead and that next following Wednesday after that will be the protest at Multnomah County Courthouse.
All right. And that's in the morning, you said?
That'll be from, we usually start at 10, so I'll say we'll get there about 9 or 2. We usually end at about 2.
So that's tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. until 2 in the afternoon outside the Multnomah County Courthouse, which is located at 1021 Southwest 4th Avenue. Also in town for yesterday's event was Donna Martin, the sister of Andre Gladden, a legally blind man who was shot and killed by a Portland police officer on January 6th after allegedly trespassing in an apartment near Adventist Medical Center. Gladden's family says that he was likely suffering from a schizophrenic episode at the time, and they have also taken issue with the official record. Gladden's family plans to hold their own celebration of Andre's life in Portland at Adventist Medical Center on July 6th, the six-month anniversary of his death. This is a clip from a lengthy interview with Donna Martin conducted over the weekend, focusing on the response that she and her family have received from Portland city officials and the changes they would like to see implemented to prevent further deaths like Andre's. A longer edit will run on our next show on July 2nd, just ahead of the celebration of life on July 6th. The full interview will be posted to the Totality of Circumstances page at kboo.fm in the meantime. Yeah, and I want to ask you, you've met, you and several other of your family members have met with Mayor Wheeler of Portland and Chief Daniel Outlaw. Do you get the impression that they understand that, what you were just describing, how this affects families as well as the people who were there at the scene?
So the impression that I got from them was, in all honesty and having empathy for a situation, just seeing it, I got the impression from them that they told me exactly what the family wanted to hear. What you would say to anybody, whether they're ill, oh, I hope you get well, or something of that nature. It was just a repetitive surface response to what occurred. Obviously, if you've lost a loved one, I would, you know, send out my condolences, but actually truly interested in how do we bring this person to justice, being as though bringing this person to justice requires placing one of your police officers in handcuffs. That was not something they were willing to do. When Danielle and Chief of Police and Outlaw, the mayor, stated that we're going to bring this person to justice, they will indeed suffer the consequences of their actions. They meant that. They meant that if it was not one of their officers. But the fact that it is one of their officers, he was completely not held responsible for his actions. They were completely, they looked to be sympathetic to the situation. I personally asked Ms. Outlaw if this were her children, if you would put your child or your husband, your spouse, some one of your loved ones in the shoes of Andre Gladden on January 6th, would you, in your position, allow this to slide or look away? And obviously her answer was no. But because this happened to be one of the officers beneath you, we can shun away from it and say that, oh, this was justified because of qualified immunity. There was no threat per the officer. There was no threat per Andre to the witness's house in which he arrived at. She identified her having children, African-American children, that she totally understands what this is about. She totally understands in the event that she should lose them in such a manner that of our anger and our frustration, our willingness to get the answers. But my question to her was very direct, and still she did not answer my question. But her, I need for them to understand that this is not just because you have African-American children, that has nothing to do with the situation. This has to do with the de-escalation techniques that they were trained to perform in the field in which they didn't. This has nothing to do with black and white. This has to do with the moral compass of the officers that they are letting patrol our streets. These officers that I'm made aware of, they do not live in Portland, Oregon. They are outside individuals from a totally different community coming to patrol a community that they have no knowledge, history, or legacy of the people, of the members of the community that reside there. So if you place these officers back into their communities, they would behave much differently as they do on and off camera. But for this to occur under their watch, knowing the history that a multitude of these officers have and their demeanor, whether it's a police-involved shooting or excessive force, it's not proper. It's not proper. It's not ethical. It's not lawful to patrol in the manner in which they do. As far as I'm made aware, the officers are not drug test in screening. There should be some type of screening as you would apply for a job. They do a background check on you. So when this officer goes and have lives, has the ability to play judge, jury, and executioner all in one second and eliminate that victim or that person from their due time in court to be justified before the court, the officer completely removes him of that that right.
Yeah.
Need to understand there's a training that takes place. And I hear a lot of people that continue to say, well, the officers need to be trained. They need to be trained. Well, the officers are trained. They're trained to do what they're doing. They patrol our streets as if this is a game. We get no do-overs because you mistake a phone for a gun, or you mistake a flashlight for a baton, or you mistake these different types of instruments for weapons. But what's extremely odd for me is that these officers are on duty, and they man weapons all day, every day, batons, guns, knives, tasers. How do you constantly mistake a cellular device for a gun when you're holding these weapons all day? You should be able to know the feel, the look of them, the distance in which you can identify a person, whether their hands up or they're running or their back is turned. All these mistakes are too many mistakes that are causing individuals their lives. And after you discover this was indeed not a weapon, you go and use the qualified immunity to say, ah, I didn't know, or it was a mistake. Because it was a mistake, we don't get to press the reset button and bring our loved ones back. It's definitely a huge thing for me. If we have the ability to change bills and policies that are in place. The people put these people in place to govern over our families and make sure that we are served and protected justifiably under the law. But if the law is not upholding the law or using common sense or their moral compass to do what they were sworn under oath to do, then I think that they need to remove themselves.
That was Donna Martin, the sister of Andre Gladden. The family is coming up from Sacramento and other parts of California on July 6th to hold a celebration of Andre's life outside Adventist Medical Center on Southeast Market Street. We'll have more information about that event on our next show in 2 weeks' time on July 2nd. Again, the full interview with Donna Martin will be posted to the Totality of Circumstances page at kboo.fm shortly. Thank you again for listening to KBOO Portland. This is Totality of Circumstances. You may remember from about 5 minutes ago, Donna Martin mentioned her family's desire to have cops pass a psychological screening before being hired. As it happens, a bill requiring just that passed last month in the Oregon legislature. We profiled a small handful of police-related bills on this show back in March, and the psych screening bill, along with a companion officer wellness bill, is one of the only ones to make it this far. Two of the bills we were most excited about focused on limiting an arbitrator's ability to overturn disciplinary rulings against law enforcement officers. In a city where the police union appeals every misconduct decision involving use of force or deadly force or other mistreatment of citizens, and pushes for binding arbitration after officers are fired by the city's elected and appointed officials, these relatively modest bills might have put a few checks on those powers. Discipline being overturned through arbitration is not only infuriating for officials and many of their constituents, it can also be expensive and lengthy. One such example is the firing of Officer Ron Frashour, who shot Aaron Campbell in the back with an AR-15 while the distraught black man was turning back towards the door to his home during a police call in 2010. Then-Mayor Sam Adams fired Frashour after multiple reviews from within and without the police bureau. After a lengthy legal process pushed by the police association, an arbitrator overturned the firing, and Frashour was reinstated several years later with years of back pay, and is still a sworn police officer. The two bills addressing arbitration, SB 383 and SB 437, both sadly perished in committee. While they were both strongly opposed by the police union lobby, represented at public hearings by lobbyist Michael Salvaggio of the statewide police union group ORCOPS, the unions made a point of coming out strongly in favor of the two bills related to officer mental health, SB 423 and 424. They passed both houses unanimously. Here is State Senator Lou Frederick of North and Northeast Portland, who sponsored both bills, describing what they do at the final hearing on them last month.
Over the past few years, policing has come under intense scrutiny due to excessive use of force and officer-involved shootings. And I brought bills regarding both of those issues to the legislature each session since 2009. One of the most important aspects of this conversation has been neglected in this national conversation, and that's the mental health of officers and how it may contribute to their job performance. Senate Bill 423 and 424 attempt to address those issues. Senate Bill 423 calls for a psychological screening of all new law enforcement officers or those transferring between agencies. Why? Well, there's a concern about the psychological fitness of officers as they begin their likely stressful careers as they begin their time working in Oregon. The simple part of this is, simplicity is this. I want someone who says that their major goal is to protect and serve, not to catch and find and catch the bad guys. Because many worry at a certain point, if that's your motivation, you're likely to see everyone you meet as a potential bad guy. That mindset creates its own problems in the community, and I'd frankly like to avoid those problems. Senate Bill 424 requires each law enforcement agency to institute a mental health wellness policy. This proposal will encourage agencies to begin thinking about the mental health of their officers in the same way that their physical and well-being has been prioritized in recent decades. I should tell you that we have two cities in Oregon that are now nationally recognized as programs for this particular mental health effort, and that's Hillsborough and Bend. They are now their efforts are being publicized and reported in both academic and other journals around the world as a result of that. I frankly believe this will bring down the stress for everyone.
It's hard to overstate the support that law enforcement managers have shown for these bills, and along with the general approval of police unions as well representing rank-and-file officers. Here is Marion County Undersheriff Troy Clausen testifying at the same hearing.
Chair Williamson, Representative Bynum, on the Senate side, during testimony on this bill and on Senate Bill 437 that dealt with broader misconduct issues, Chief Yamashita, who's currently the chief in Gladstone but was chief in Sandy, testified that there was, when she inherited this Sandy Police Department, they did not do psychological evaluations, inherited an officer on the Brady list, had been terminated but reinstated through arbitration. It was her fervent belief, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for Chief Yamashita. She's one of the first people I call when I have questions dealing with her with police matters, that this person would never have been hired had the agency conducted a psychological evaluation, and I trust that opinion.
Again, that was Marion County Undersheriff Troy Clausen. Both of those bills were signed into law by Governor Kate Brown soon after passing the State House last month. But back to arbitration for a minute. A recent arbitration case in Cincinnati, Ohio, shows the sort of power that police unions can wield and how ready they are to wield it no matter what the details are. In 2018, Cincinnati police officer Kevin Brown tasered an 11-year-old, 90-pound child named Dunisha Gowdy during a shoplifting incident at a Kroger supermarket. Brown told Gowdy to stop what she was doing. Gowdy reportedly began running from Brown, who pulled his taser and fired it into Gowdy's back, knocking her to the floor. After this, Brown, who like Gowdy is black, can be heard on body cam footage telling the young girl, quote, "You know, sweetheart, this is why there are no stores in the black community," end quote. An internal affairs investigation found that Brown violated four policies: using prejudicial language, failing to turn on his body cam until after the taser had been fired, failing to warn Gowdy that he was about to fire the taser, and using the taser in a situation that was not serious enough to warrant it. Police Chief Elliot Isaacs slapped Brown with a 7-day suspension and confined him to the Telephone Crimes Unit for 2 months. The local branch of the Fraternal Order of Police, led by President Dan Hills, appealed the decision. The Fraternal Order of Police, or FOP, by the way, is one of the few national-level police unions with a lot of locals, similar to other union models. The FOP pointed out that at the time Brown tasered Gowdy, Cincinnati police policy allowed officers to taser children as young as 7, and that in several prior cases, officers who tasered young children received no discipline at all. In the aftermath of the incident, the department reviewed its taser policy and raised that age limit. The city also reached a $240,000 settlement with Gowdy's family. According to WCPO Cincinnati, Hills characterized the department's review of the incident, the policy changes, and the settlement as, quote, "Monday morning quarterbacking," unquote, and summed up the official and public reactions saying, quote, "Some people shot off their mouth," unquote. An arbitrator wound up agreeing, if not necessarily in those words. and ordered Officer Brown reinstated with back pay. The arbitrator was swayed by examples given by the police union of other times when officers had tasered young children and been given zero discipline, saying, quote, "It is axiomatic that similarly situated employees must be treated similarly," unquote. The arbitrator did make a point of saying that Gowdy posed no threat to Brown, though she did pose a threat to herself by running away. Again, that's the arbitrator's words. The arbitrator also said that if the city of Cincinnati's new taser policy had been in effect when Brown tasered Gowdy, he would indeed have been out of policy. The arbitrator did find that Brown had violated other policies, such as failing to turn on his body cam in a timely manner, but also reached the conclusion that Brown's admonition about why there are no stores in the black community could be chalked up to Brown trying to, quote, mentor Dunisha Gowdy. One can only wonder what Gowdy actually learned from this ordeal. Thank you for listening to Totality of Circumstances on KBOO Portland. We air every Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. Excuse me, every other Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. Our next show will be July 2nd, 2019, in 2 weeks. In the meantime, tomorrow at 10 a.m. is the Patrick Kimmons protest at Multnomah County Courthouse at 1021 Southwest 4th. On June 25th, a Tuesday, is the main meeting of the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, or PCEP. That'll be at 2511 Northeast MLK at 5:30. And on the 26th, Wednesday, the PCEP's Subcommittee for People with Mental Illness is going to meet at 805 Southeast 122nd Avenue, and I believe that's at 5:30 as well. And then on July 2nd is our next show, and the day after that is the July meeting of the Citizen Review Committee at City Hall at 5:30. And on the 6th, which is a Saturday, will be the Angelversary, or Celebration of Life, for Andre Gladden at Adventist Medical Center on Southeast Market Street in East Portland. Thank you, everybody, for listening. My name is Sam Bowman. I'm usually joined by Jasmine Moneymaker, and we produce Totality of Circumstances here on KBOO Portland. If you have any questions, comments, tips, or if you would like to get involved in this show or with KBOO in general, you can email totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio@gmail.com, and you can check out our website at the Totality of Circumstances page on KBOO.fm. Have a wonderful night.
Meet me on the mountain.
KBOO wants you to meet us where the music's at.
You can see awesome live bands like Fruition.
That's right. KBOO wants to send you to a concert this summer.
Just enter the KBOO Summer Music Raffle, where three lucky winners will choose in order from three awesome events.
You could win 2 3-day passes to the Northwest String Summit, July 19th to the 21st.
A pair of Sunday tickets to Pickathon, August 4th.
A pair of tickets to Lord Huron and Shaky Graves at the Oregon Zoo, August 12th.
Tickets are just $5, and if you buy 4, you get an extra raffle chance for free.
Enter at kboo.fm/give, or you can buy tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summermusicraffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for a live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues